Hi, film fans. How are you? I hope this finds you well and that you have had a wonderful weekend. Maybe you've been to the cinema to see some stuff. I had a bit of a catch up with a load of things last week. I saw three films in one day. It was pretty extraordinary, actually. I saw Civil War, which is the new Alex Garland film. I saw Back to Black, which is the new film from Sam Taylor-Johnson about Amy Winehouse. And I also saw, what else did I see? Love Lies Bleeding, Rose Glass's new film. All were extraordinary. I was full to bursting from just being so impressed by all three films. And the great news is that we're going to be talking about all three films on future episodes of the podcast. But let me know what you've seen at the cinema recently or something you've watched streaming-wise. It's always great to find out what you've kind of tapped into and what you've enjoyed. It could be a film from years ago. It could be something brand new. But please let us know. It'd be lovely to hear what you've been enjoying and watching. You could do that on email. It's info@edithbowman.com. Over the years, there have been people that I've tried to get on this podcast, and for various reasons, it just hasn't happened. And there was one particular person that I had been trying to get on for a while, and it became apparent quite quickly that they were ill and unfortunately passed away. And it's coming up to the year anniversary of the death of Ryuichi Sakamoto. And I guess the thing that we can take away as comfort is that we've been able to celebrate and talk about his music on this podcast through various people. For me, one person in particular was Luca Guadagnino, talking about him, how he used his existing music in Call Me By Your Name. And our wonderful opportunity that we have this week is our latest guest on Soundtracking is Neil Sora, the son of Ryuichi Sakamoto and director of A Final Gift to the Japanese Composers fans. It's called Opus. It was recorded in late 2022 with just Sakamoto and a Yamaha Grand. Opus sees Ryuichi perform his most haunting, personal and delicate melodies in equally just haunting and delicate black and white. I watched this film twice in one day and kind of got so much from it. Incredibly emotional performance as well. And what was brilliant was being able to talk to Neil about the journey to making this film. For him, obviously, an incredibly personal one, an emotional one. But just in terms of how his dad came up with the track listing and the songs that he wanted to choose to feature in this last performance, something that he didn't necessarily share through words, but more through the emotion within the music. Opus features many of Ryuichi's most loved compositions performed solo at the piano, including probably one of his most famous, Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence.
Hey Neil, how are you?
I'm okay, how are you?
Yeah, I'm really great, thank you. I'm really grateful for your time today, so I very much appreciate you.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have this chat.
I watched the film yesterday and then I had to watch it again. It's a beautiful gift and it's got this kind of wonderful journey, almost a sort of meditative journey in a way, whilst also taking you on an incredibly emotional journey. You know, just as being a fan, but also just allowing yourself to be kind of taken where those pieces take you, really. It's a beautiful gift, as I said. So thank you.
Thank you.
I can't imagine it's particularly easy to talk about it, with the emotional connection to making this wonderful thing with your dad, but also you must take a wonderful kind of pride in being able to capture this with him and, you know, fulfill this desire in him to play these pieces in this way, in this order, in this situation.
I definitely was happy to have had this opportunity because I think in the moment I was very aware of it as well, but it was made much more clear to me after the film started to play at various film festivals. You know, audience members would come up to me and talk about how lucky that they thought I was to be able to do something like this with my own father, because, you know, their parent or father or mother just passed away and they really wish they could have done something like that. And so I think it's really rare to have such an opportunity of collaboration. And so, you know, that's something that I feel very grateful for.
How did the conversation, you know, start with regards to what this would be and, you know, and that collaboration, like you say, about how it would be captured and what he wanted it to be, but also what he wanted you to want it to be?
No, I'm trying to remember what the conversation was like. And, you know, during the whole process of making the film, I think he and I had a kind of a professional separation of domains. You know, I handled the filmmaking and he handled the music. And my job that I, you know, that I really intended to do was to be just a conduit for what he wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And so the conversation was more practical in, you know, his management team came to me and they were like, you know, we really want you to do this because we don't really know at what point in the future you'll be able to do this anymore because of his health. And I was actually, you know, fairly busy actually with a separate project completely, with my own film project that I had going on, pre-producing. But, you know, I didn't want to regret anything yet again. So then I put down that and just decided I would, you know, go ahead and head first with Opus.
Yeah. The running order, the set list, this collection of songs and the order that they're in, was that something that he talked to you about? The breadth and the depth of his work over the years in terms of the idea of putting together a collection of songs for this particular project and what it meant. I can't imagine that was an easy decision to make in terms of what he played and what he, you know, what he kept in there, what he didn't. Did you talk to him about how he came to that decision about the pieces that he wanted to include in Opus?
To be honest, not really. First of all, you know, something that I would like to say is, you know, I mentioned that there was a professional separation between the domain of filmmaking and music, and choosing the set list was, you know, something in his domain. So I basically let him, you know, do whatever he wanted, essentially. But, you know, because this was a film shoot, and film shoots require a good deal of pre-production and preparation. Something that I did ask for, and I did exercise my, you know, right as a filmmaker, was to ask for a set list early, that I could pass it off to the crew members, to have the crew members and camera operators learn the music as best as possible.
Yeah.
And that's something that he doesn't usually do. I think he usually picks the set list fairly close to the performance. And even during the performance, he would switch it up depending on the atmosphere of the room. But I asked him, please, you know, nail down the set list. He was like, oh, whoa, okay. Sure. And then he produced a 20-song set list. I don't know the conversation that went behind the 20 songs. He gave it to me. And based on that, I went back to my collaborators, mainly Bill Kirstein, who is a cinematographer. And in order to come up with a visual through line of the film, I proposed we go by the concept of depicting the light and how it changes during the course of one day. You know, that inspiration, of course, came from, you know, my father himself, really interested in the passage of time, the idea of that. When I proposed that concept, you know, wanting to depict the concert as if it was passing, you know, the passage of time during the day from night into morning back into night again. He reordered some of the music in order to fit that atmosphere. So he would say, you know, this song feels a little bit more like morning, so maybe we can hear it here. So there was a little bit of collaboration there. But other than that, actually, largely, you know, he made all the decisions about the music. And then one request that I made was that final song, Opus. I requested that song to be the final song. Actually, I mean, I didn't request it Opus specifically, but I wanted the film to end with some music that was rather not as emotionally climactic as Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence. And instead, I wanted to end the song with something as, I don't know the best word I can have to describe it, but like quotidian. The feeling that life goes on. And I suggested a couple of songs. One of them was Opus. And he was a little bit surprised by that, but he liked the idea. And so he agreed to that request.
The aesthetic of the film is just absolutely beautiful. You know, the light and the choice of shooting it in black and white, and you know that silhouette of him with, you know, and his fabulous hair, that kind of great presence, and his hands, and just so beautifully shot. It really, really is. How did you come to that decision on how you wanted to shoot it and how you wanted it to look, and the fact that we feel like we're almost kind of have the luxury of being able to kind of float around that piano in a way, you know, we're kind of like get that luxury of feeling like we're in the room, and we're, you know, we get that close up to see his hands, and we come around the other side of the piano. It's just, it's so immersive. But how did you come to the decision on how you wanted it to look?
The way that, you know, I like to think about style in filmmaking is the style should always come out of what you want to film, of course.
Yeah.
And it should be faithful to the thing that you're trying to show in the film. And something that Bill and I were talking about a lot was to depict the physicality of a performance and the body and the hands and wrinkles. And, you know, that also made it into the sound mix as well, to capture the breathing and the kind of rustle.
Yeah.
And so the physicality of the performer and also the physicality of the piano itself as this kind of grand object, those were something that we were definitely thinking about a lot. And again, talking about the passage of time as we spoke. And then also I was thinking a lot about what it means to depict rhythm and music in the visual medium. I was thinking a lot about abstract cinema, abstract films. The one point of interest or inspiration that I had was this Dada film, early Dada film called Ballet Mécanique, that really experimented with black and white shapes on screen. And there was an idea that I had about the kind of purest form of visual pleasure being these shapes of black and white being put to motion. And so I was wondering, you know, I wonder if there is some kind of way to depict the subjectivity out of an audience member being carried away in music, carried away by the rhythms and the tones. And so all of those ideas kind of came together in the decision to make the film black and white, because I thought the idea of making it black and white really stripped away this one other layer of visual information that exists, color, and brought everything together in a unified way. And once that was set, you know, there was one day where I said, hey, Bill, I think we should shoot it black and white. And he was like, really? And I was like, yes. And so after that, everything really came together. And that really helped us, I think, figure out camera movement and lighting and everything else as well. So yeah, that's how that came to be. And again, in terms of camera movement, your other question, that was very much about how we can give audience members the kind of illusion or the subjective experience of what it's like to maybe be at a concert. Because I think, I don't know how often you go to these classical concerts, but even if you're sitting really far away, once you start to get into the music in this emotional way, I feel like you kind of experience being really close to the performer or in the music.
It's just you in the room almost. Yeah.
Exactly. And so I think that's something that we were really careful about.
You mentioned that kind of the breathing and the few times that he speaks as well, you know, in terms of kind of this is hard, you know, and the breath and the you're breathing at certain points and stuff, it pulls you in even more kind of thing. You know, you kind of almost feel like you want to get closer to what's going on. It's such a such a visceral experience kind of hearing that kind of those breaths. And it's not all the time, you know, it's kind of just the moments that you hear it. And, you know, that feels like it's been really kind of beautifully crafted to make sure that you have those at the right moments for the right reasons.
Yeah, that was crafted by our recording engineer, Zach, who is a very legendary figure in the Japanese scene. And Zach and my father have been collaborating since, I believe, like about 2009. Yeah, he very much understands the ideas of what he wanted to do, in that what was most interesting to him as a performer was the lack of the boundary between musical sound and sound that surrounds us in daily life. Mm-hmm. And those moments where the decay of one note of the piano gradually fading and turning into silence, and what the sound of silence even is. And so the kind of microphone setups that Zach brought in and used was very, very tuned to those details. That actually posed a big problem for filmmaking as well, because that meant we couldn't, and obviously we couldn't make any sounds, but especially like even very small creaks in the floor.
Everybody was in their socks and you had the floor all kind of padded up and stuff as well.
Very difficult.
I watched Coda again, you know, in terms of when I was kind of almost watched it in between viewings of Opus, and just talking about the idea of sounds around you. And that was such a big part of kind of your dad's journey into creating, really, in terms of being aware and listening. And I love that scene in Coda where he goes out the back door with the plastic tub on his head, kind of to hear the kind of sound of rain and water through the amplification of a plastic bucket over his head. It was amazing to kind of revisit that film, and the piano as well. And this lovely moment where he talks about, you know, it's not just the note that you play, it's kind of the reverberation of it and the way that it kind of almost fades off into nothing in a way as well. It's kind of it's amazing companion almost film to your film as well. I think
I agree. I think Opus and Coda are very good companion films. You know, I was brought in by the director Stephen Schibble to film some home scenes, you know, right in the moment where he got cancer for the first time. The director Stephen was very respectful about those boundaries in terms of filming at home. But then actually it was my parents that said, Stephen, as a director, you should want to film this, right? Like, this is the most dramatic moment. And so that's one of the reasons why they brought me in right out of school. Personally, I like films that don't handhold too much. You know, something that I was really thinking about while helping the director film Coda was, you know, how can a film represent somebody but without any words and only through music? And so I feel like I was able to do that in Opus a little. Not that I had too much control over it, but yes, I think I was able to do that a little bit more. And yeah, I think the idea that music is not about making music as a performer, but it's an attitude to listening to what's around you.
Yeah.
That's something that he really thought about and put into action a lot. And that's something that he really received from John Cage as one of the most important things about how to approach music and sound in the world.
That's a lovely pull through between the two films of, you know, I'm so glad that Shelter in Sky is in there. And when he talks about that in Coda, you know, and he has the book and he's talking about, you know, the scene in the film and his face kind of when he hears how the sound of the sound bowls kind of works in that particular, you can just see the kind of joy in the creation, you know, of that kind of marriage of those worlds of the moving image and the narrative and the characters with the sound and the music from what he's created and his determination as well, you know, right through to Revenant, you know, with Alejandro and just how determined he was that it was something he was so desperate to do, even though he was, you know, clearly, you know, not in the best health sort of thing as well. You know, for you in terms of seeing him create over the years and seeing him be inspired by, you know, all different types of medium, whether it be film, games, for his own, you know, his own music and stuff as well. The particular things that really resonate or stand out with you that have then ended up in this film that you remember at their kind of at their birth or at their, you know, when they were being created. I mean, I'm married to a musician, so I know how private that kind of world can be, you know, in terms of keeping yourself to yourself, really, because it comes from somewhere. So it's not like you're kind of, you know, sat at the dinner table talking about what you made that day. But I just wondered from growing up around your dad creating all this amazing music over the years, if there was anything for you that you really remember as a moment of kind of hearing him create or, you know, a collaboration that he may have worked on with a director or something that has ended up in your film that you're kind of really, you can see that kind of through line from when it was created to the fact that you were able to celebrate that in this film.
Well, that's a good question. No one has ever asked me that before, and it's making me really remember a lot of things. But something that definitely in the film I realized is how I think there's always a tension between two poles of being for him. And the main two poles, there's many contradictions within himself at all times, you know, including growing up through Western music, but then also Western classical music, but then also, you know, wanting to break away from the sphere of influence of the West to approach ethnomusicology and, you know, things like this. But the big kind of contradiction that I was really feeling that for me became articulated through the film was his tension between intellectualism and being a very sappy, sentimental person. I think he's, obviously it comes out in the music. But even in the most melodramatic and sappy moments in his compositions, there's always this inhibitor in his mind, this kind of voice in his mind that says, that's too cheesy, you know, that's going a little too far in sentiment. And like all these things that kind of is always there. And he's always trying to complicate the chords or complicate the harmony in those kinds of ways. And I think most of the music that he comes up with and composes is on the spectrum of this kind of pure conceptual experiment in form and then just pure emotion that like just came to him one way or else. And in that kind of sense, I really do remember moments where mother and I would be in the dining room getting ready to eat breakfast or something like that. And I would be told to go and get my father to work on some music downstairs. I would approach and start to hear some music. And in those kinds of moments, I don't want to disturb. And so I would kind of peek over. And I would find him there just like playing music on the synthesizer or piano and then just like kind of crying to his own music, which is something that it was quite shocking when I first saw that. And that kind of seared in my memory. You know, he was very embarrassed about it when I caught it. You know, I thought it was like kind of embarrassing too when I saw it, but I think it kind of is a testament to how much vulnerability goes into putting these emotions in music. Yeah. And I want to rephrase that, because I don't necessarily know if you have the emotion first and you're trying to depict an emotion through music per se. I think music is really fascinating. And it's something that I feel like somehow is one of the most purest forms of ways to deliver emotion that you don't have words for. And I think it's like a really miraculous moment where a performer plays music where the emotion is created and felt by the performer in the same moment of playing. And I think there's something really magical about, you know, it's a simultaneous occurrence of the urge to bring something out from inside of you, but then the notes and music that comes out of you is affecting you at the same time emotionally. And it's just this kind of feedback cycle, momentary feedback cycle, just a little bit that gets created simultaneously. A lot of that happened in the film. And I think, by bringing the cameras really close up, it did, maybe we're able to hint at that at least a little bit.
So beautiful. It's that idea that it's having a conversation almost with what's being created. And I feel like this journey that we go on in the film through the music and what it's saying to us, you know, it's that thing as an artist, when you unleash your art into the world, it's not yours anymore. It belongs to whoever's listening to it, sort of thing. But to start off with, you're putting some kind of emotion or narrative into that in terms of what you are trying to say from you to create that. And I feel like there's such a beautiful unspoken story through the playlist of this film. Yeah, what this collection of songs is saying.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, you know, the, how do I phrase it? The resolution with which an audience member can pick apart a story from the film. I would say the film isn't that kind to an audience member who doesn't know anything about, you know, his backstory or anything like that, because it doesn't give you any kind of factual background or interviews, or it's just him and his music.
You don't need it, whether you are, you know, you know lots about him and his history and what he's, you know, his story, or you don't. I feel like the film kind of can connect on both levels, really can.
And yeah, thanks for saying that. But, you know, obviously there are some people who are like, I wish I knew a little bit more about him. But I definitely come back to the idea of the concert. You know, I think whenever I've gone to these kind of classical concerts, or not even classical, any kind of concert, and then you want to learn more about them. But I think if you do know, and if you did follow his career for a very long time, I think you get this sense of, I don't know if you're familiar with Glenn Gould's work, but, you know, Glenn Gould, amazing Canadian pianist who has two completely iconic renditions of the Goldberg Variations, you know, one early in his career, and then one at the very end of his career. And those two versions of the Goldberg Variations just completely tell the story of his whole life. And if you know his career, you can definitely sense those changes. And the biggest one that a lot of people always bring up, and it's Tong Pu, the techno song that showcased his virtuosity on the keys early on. It was always a duet, very fast and really energetic. And then this version is really slow and pared down. And I think a lot of people who do follow his career, who did follow his career, really picked up on those kinds of things. To be honest, I think those fans know a lot more about his career than I do.
That's great, though, because everybody can take their own thing from it.
I agree, yeah.
Listen, I could chat to you for hours about this, and I genuinely can't wait to watch it again. I just think it's something I'll go back to again and again, because I think as well that, you know, you talk about the kind of variations on the way he's performed these tunes. I think almost you'll have variations on the way that you listen to them or you hear them. Yeah, it's kind of like a living thing, I think.
It really does kind of depend on, you know, where you are emotionally.
Yeah. Yeah, I was sobbing yesterday. I was in a better place today, but I was sobbing yesterday. Neil, so great to chat to you. Thank you so much for your time today. And I really look forward to what's next, and, you know, in terms of what you're making next as a filmmaker, and continue to watch your success in your art as well. But thank you for this this wonderful gift.
Thank you so much. And yeah, it's, you know, the things that I'm working on personally are very different. And so this, I think, opus is something that is unique. And I truly don't feel like I can claim any like authorial credit over it. I think it's truly, it was something that my father wants to do. And I tried to be as faithful to that as possible. But thank you so much for the conversation.
You too. Thank you so much. You take care.
As featured in Opus, that's The Wuthering Heights by Ryuichi Sakamoto, rounding off this latest episode of Soundtracking with Neil Sora. My huge thanks to Neil for taking the time to talk to me. Also to Adam, who helped me set up the interview. Really appreciate all your work on that. Opus is in selected cinemas for previews on the 28th of March and then released on the 29th. Please, if you can, go and see it. It's a really rewarding and rich experience. Head to edithbowman.com to hear all of my conversations I've had with directors, writers, actors, producers, editors, composers about film and music. We really try and cover all bases. Soundtrack and Extra is our YouTube channel, which we'd really appreciate you subscribing to. You can also follow us on socials. We are at Soundtracking UK. I mentioned at the start of this episode that we had loads of great guests coming up over the next couple of weeks and wanted just to throw forward to some of those. Dev Patel will be on talking about Monkey Man, which is his directorial debut. He also wrote it and stars in it. Back to Black we'll be talking about with Sam Taylor-Johnson. Alex Garland will be coming back on the podcast to talk about Civil War. I mentioned Luca Guadagnino. We're hoping to have on to talk about Challengers, his new film. And also Rose Glass talking about Love Lies Bleeding. We're also going to have a conversation with Matt Bellamy from Muse and the composer Ilan Eshkari. The pair of those have collaborated on the score for the Audible version of George Orwell's 1984 that is coming out on the 4th of April. But we're very excited about all those guests and welcoming you back for another episode of Soundtracking. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.